Poet and visual artist Bianca Stone has a lot to live up to as the granddaughter of the National Book Award-winning poet Ruth Stone, but she embraces her late grandmother's legacy of a really strong voice both in life and poetry.
Listening to her read her poems out loud with her certain cadence was how I learned to read out loud, and it's actually such a good lesson to learn how to speak your poems to give them as much justice as they deserve.
Bianca Stone also describes forays into her own unique genre with poetry comics from The Book of Hours and Someone Else's Wedding Vows, today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and I talked with the Brooklyn poet while she was a 2016 guest of Pleiades Press at the University of Central Missouri. Bianca's mother was one of three daughters Ruth raised alone after her husband committed suicide in 1959. Throughout her sometimes itinerant life as a teacher at various schools across the country, Ruth always wrote. And finally, thanks to the money from various writing awards, she was able to settle in the farmhouse in Goshen, Vermont, that Bianca Stone says was bought, repaired, and held up with poetry. Most of Ruth Stone's 13 books were published late in life after her granddaughter's birth in 1983, so Bianca got to witness the poetry life directly.
Since I had a single mother, my grandmother was a huge part of my life. I spent a lot of my time with her. She really helped raise me. And she took me to all her poetry readings, insisted that I write poems, and had me memorizing poems, you know, included me in all the conversations she had with her friends. So for me, it was just invaluable. It's why I'm a poet today, because she was just so generous with her poetry spirit with everyone, but I was really lucky to have a really close relationship with her, and it just infected me really early on to love poetry and really want to write it and feel like good about writing it and sharing it. So she's been the biggest influence on my poetry, and I feel like a lot of my poems almost are in conversation with some of her poems and are responding to some of her concerns and touch on the same things. And I definitely have her voice and music in my work. It's something that you kind of have to like be careful with, because you don't want to overstep and get too mired in somebody else's voice. But for sure, her spirit is in all my work.
Oh, that's really neat.
Yeah.
I read that you're heading up the Ruth Stone Foundation now and your grandmother's house up in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
You want to make that a writer's retreat.
Yeah, I started that after she passed away. She left her entire estate in trust for the furthering of poetry and the arts. And I'm one of the trustees, and this is something we talked about a lot when she was alive. And our biggest goal is to fix up her house in Goshen, which was an epicenter of creativity for her and for her colleagues and friends.
And this is Goshen, Vermont.
This is Goshen, Vermont. Dirt road, up in the mountains, no stores. It's great. I spent a lot of my life there, and it's like magical to me. It's really, it's just like being there is just, oh, it's so inspiring. The house, even in its heyday, was in need of a lot of repair. It's really an old farmhouse. There's actually three houses on the property. It's only a little over 2 acres. It's a very small amount of space, but these really old, kind of ramshackly, beautiful houses. So a lot of our work with the foundation has been to raise money to repair them. And also all my grandmother's things were still in the house. So it's going through somebody's entire lifetime of hoarding their beautiful stuff and papers and books and artifacts. And a lot of what we do has been just cataloging and cleaning and storing, and we're selling her papers. But yeah, we're going to make it into a writer's space, you know, really intimate writer's retreats with people getting to stay there for various lengths of time and write in her space with all her stuff there. And
I think that would be fabulous.
Yeah. And we want to like focus on single mothers or mothers who want space and time to do their writing. We're going to allow it so they can either bring their children and we'll have free childcare there, or we'll provide childcare where they're from. So just providing opportunities for people like grandma and like my sister, for example, or my mother, to really give them space and opportunity to focus on their writing, even though they want to be mothers as well full time. So we're just doing so much with it. It's going so well. Right now we're part of Fractured Atlas as our fiscal sponsor. So we have the same benefits as a nonprofit. If people want to donate, it's tax deductible. We're just becoming our own 501c3, the paperwork's in, but we completely depend on private donations. So we just became a National Historical Literary Landmark, which is really exciting.
Congratulations. Yeah, that is exciting.
Yeah, that was like years worth of work.
Well, I love all those goals. And I think the fact that it could be a place for single mothers mm-hmm. and children to come is unusual. Bianca Stone, talking about the Ruth Stone Foundation for New Letters on the Air. Well, your most recent book is called Poetry Comics from the Book of Hours. And before that, you had a collection of poetry called Someone Else's Wedding Vows. You are wonderful with titles. Titles are really hard, and I think you have a knack at grabbing them.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, it's super important. If you can have that title come to you, it's quite a gift. I remember with Someone Else's Wedding Vows, for the poem, I thought of the title first, and the poem really came after that.
I'm sure it's probably different with different poems.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I would say, like, most of the time, the title comes afterwards. It's really lucky if you can come up with the title first, because it is really great. I mean, a lot of times when I'm reading a poem, I think, oh, I haven't even read the title yet. You know, as a reader of poetry, the title almost seems not as important as the whole poem. But then, of course, when there's those great famous titles like The Wasteland, it just is so powerful.
Well, why don't we start by having you read the title poem of your first collection, Someone Else's Wedding Vows?
Sure. My sister's a photographer on the side. She's also a writer, but she did a kind of slew of weddings. It was three in a row. It was disorienting because they were all so similar in their formula, and it felt kind of grotesque. But I also was very taken with it, and I think I was falling in love at the time with my now husband.
Your husband is Ben Pease. And
yeah.
Is he a writer too?
He is. He's a poet. That's how we met. We met through poetry. Ages ago when I was in my MFA at NYU, I had him come read for my reading series called The Ladder. I graduated in 2009, and Ben also graduated in 2009 from Columbia University's MFA program. So I think that I was really coming to terms with what a wedding is, and I was kind of horrified and thought it was cheap, but I also really wanted it. So Someone Else's Wedding Vows. The rise of Australopithecus. The weird clouds over Long Island at the classic wedding. The crowd frightened of what it means having O'Hara's avocado salad poem read. It's an evil waste of time for me to congratulate anything. Accuracy comes to me, slips out, in fragments of my earlier works recited in the secret weapons defense committees. I'm president of the clams, seduced by food service, purple squids sinking in their own pitiful mantle, irrevocable among the dinner rolls. I would pay to feel good all the time. But I'm telling stories to the churchless evening, watching lost guests take paper plates to inoffensive tables illuminated with Greta Garbo's centerpieces. Bring me to the oak out front and tell me you love me, I say to the family dog. The pool is lit with unscented candles. Hillary stands on a chair. We're taking the wedding photographs, practicing someone else's dutiful permanence, clusters of sequin at the bar. A hand reaches around a white waist and considers literature for the first time in months. This is the sea that arranges inside us, the burning ship that drifts with its burning, anxious crew. The rest we can sum up in several lines about perpetuity. The rest we can owe to our complex digestive systems working out the squid covered in light reflective cells, changing color according to the gut, which humans will someday be able to do. This is a colder evening in September. The sun drapes its modern dread across everything. The front lawn has never had its chance with violent, unkempt beauty. But something dark stirs in the incipient mums. I want to embrace whatever is firmer and bigger than myself, like the sound of the wind around the tent, or everyone inventing their own colloquial happiness, acting out, too bored or wired with rancor to stop eating, and it's true, I spent my whole life in fear of sharing my mind, but with a longing for it to be taken. Year after year, I could not even order myself to be touched. I became a waitress who looked sad, dropping occasionally into the bed of a maniac who looked sadder and meaner. I should have gone out into the field every night to watch black bears growl and honeysuckle, or absorbed myself in the essays of Empson, which I never finished. I'm still somewhere in the mountains of Vermont, exhibiting relatively high intelligence. Somewhere I'm communicating, and where it's driest, I sit down with my wet drink. I drink for the incidental, the heart of dust, for my family and all their uneven moods, for this audience of discreet psychotics posing for photographs, for the living deer ravaging gardens, for the touch of sub-shrubs, lavender, periwinkle, and thyme, touching the lingering otherness, for this not being known, rarely knowing, and for the ordinary, monstrous knowing I love.
Someone Else's Wedding Vows. That's the title poem of Bianca Stone's first collection, and she's here with me today on New Letters on the Air.
I just was having an interaction on Facebook about it because one of the people whose weddings me and my sister photographed called me out on it. She said, isn't that about my wedding? I'm like, yes, but don't take anything personal. I felt bad that this woman thought that I may have been talking about her specific wedding. So I told her it's just kind of about, you know, everybody's wedding.
Right.
It could be any wedding.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, this particular book, Someone Else's Wedding Vows, is divided up into three different sections. And I'm going to have you read a poem from the first section. That also ends up in your newest book, Poetry Comics, Because You Love, You Come Apart. And I thought that would be a good segue into talking about what you're doing. One of the things that you create in Poetry Comics is all these images that in a way tell a different narrative than the narrative of the poem. It seems like it contrasts with it sometimes and other times picks up on it. And I'm thinking of one of the panels with I've Never Told Anyone This, which sounds so intimate, and yet your drawing has a woman sitting at a dinner table with a platter with a fish and a turkey on it and some spilled bottles of wine, and no one is sitting there with her. Mm. It's just kind of haunting.
I think that you hit on a really good point right away, which is that the narrative, so to speak, or what's happening in the poem is not what's happening in the visual art in the poetry comic. And I think that's really essential to what makes a poetry comic, because the poetry comic is sort of one interpretation of reading that poem. But I didn't want to illustrate the poem exactly how it's on the page. So I don't want to draw Dante in a brunette wood and then bones falling apart and flying in the air for the line, this is bone dust, because that's already in the poem. And I really want the reader to do the work of imagining that. And then there's this whole other part of reading a poem where the reader is creating visuals to go with it. And usually that's this completely other narrative that's going on in the reader's head that is totally different than what you see on the page. Like, it may conjure up visions of a lot of people sitting at that table or one person talking to another person. But for me, for some reason, it conjured up being very alone at a table. So it's a really tricky thing, because I think in one way it's exposing a little bit about what happens in our heads when we're reading a poem, and you don't want to wreck that special place of, like, the reader creating meaning. Although I say that, but then here I am making this drawings and changing your interpretation of what the poem would be. So it's this really kind of layered thing. But again, I think in that sense, I really don't want to illustrate the poem I really want to treat the images as if they're another line of the poem, more complicating it and forcing you to kind of put things together in your head and come up with your own conclusions.
Well, would you like to read that?
No, I think that's a great idea. Because you love, you come apart. Your hair is wonderful today. This is a microscopic caress at a party. This is the dead fathoming. This is coming home with your gorilla heart all disordered. This is feeling like a steamboat swaying at the wharf at midnight, a picnic bench weathering in wind. But this is also your life, made with your clumsy hands, your brain lighting up when you see a beautiful woman eating French fries in a dark bar. Your head is split down the middle by a brook, each hemisphere divine, witchy, out of the depths, your trouble, your grief speaking, your cartoons, the crazy absent fathers all breaking wind in a fire, and the fire engorged. And your heavy body is getting up and going. This is starting a sentence with, I've never told anyone this, and you are gruesome, hungry, at the edge of the earth, where the dead waited out. From a babble in the ground and a vortex of quilts and roots, they are listening. They want to be loved. They want to be remembered correctly. We bring ourselves to the river, and we feed ourselves coffee and blasts of airborne opiates. This is bone dust, a fistful of mint, the collected writings of Dante that cover everything in a brunette wood. There is the clear image of someone beside you who looks just like you, but can get blue bottle flies to land on her finger. This is the optic nerve, in endless reflections of your friends. This is your friends, making you a massive cake, filled with blackbirds and figs, making halos with their hands, saying loyal things, and getting emotional. This is leaving a dark bar with them. In the cab ride home, you lay in each other's arms.
That's the poem, Because You Love, You Come Apart. And it's part of Bianca Stone's first collection, Someone Else's Wedding Vows. But she's illustrated it in her newest book, Poetry Comics, from the Book of Hours. And you're listening to Bianca here on New Letters on the Air. So let's talk a little bit about your art. And I'm thinking, since that poem was in Someone Else's Wedding Vows, you wrote it first and then you did the artwork to accompany it later. What makes you decide which poems to bring to life with visuals and which to leave just as poetry?
I don't usually illustrate a long poem like that that's been published. A lot of times I'll choose fragments of poems that I'm not publishing in a book, or that are kind of earlier versions or just snippets of less big poems. And I'll use those to use in visual artwork. It's always evolving what I do. Sometimes the image is kind of happening first. Sometimes it's all happening simultaneously. Usually I have some sort of line written already. I'm not creating the poem as I'm drawing ever. So it's crazy. I think poetry comics are a completely new genre that are not poetry. I mean, it's born out of poetry, but poetry, its power comes from the reader creating meaning in their head and creating those images in their head. And you don't want to interfere with that. So you have to be really respectful of the fact that once you put an image beside a line, it's going to change everything about that line.
It really does. Mm-hmm. It's interesting for me because I read the book Poetry Comics before I read your first collection in Someone Else's Wedding Vows.
Yeah.
And so reading that in the comic form, I recognized that it was obviously the same poem, but when I read it without the artwork, I came away with a different meaning. So it was kind of nice to be able to see one with the art and then one without. It's like looking at something with a whole lot of mirrors involved because you're seeing different perspectives of it.
I'm so glad to hear that. For me, it's kind of like I'm putting it out there blind. I don't really know exactly people's reactions to it, and it's so good to know that you can still read the poem and it's not going to be affected. It's like, oh, I saw the movie first and now I can't read The Wizard of Oz without thinking of, ruby slippers.
It is kind of like that, isn't it? It's like reading a book that you've already seen the movie. I hadn't thought about that, but that is it.
But you don't want it to wreck your experience of reading the book ever. You know, you want to come up with your own vision of Harry Potter. But that's never going to happen.
Well, speaking of movies, mm-hmm. I've read that you've actually done some work with moving images as well. And your poetry, right?
Right. It's really similar to poetry comics. I mean, I would put it under the same category because you're reading your poem and then assembling, visuals to go with it. I've experimented a lot with stop animation and my own artwork. So kind of influenced by William Kentridge's moving images and his animations. Building up a drawing, taking pictures while I'm doing it, while I'm drawing an image and taking it apart, wrecking it, changing it, having it all videotaped while I'm doing it, and then having the poem over it. So just kind of experimenting with different things. But, I mean, I don't know what I'm doing at all. I'm just completely winging it and having a good time. I've always loved video.
Well, I'm going to ask you to pick a poem to have you read from someone else's wedding vows.
All right. But since I flew here, I can't fly without thinking of this poem I wrote. Reading a science article on the airplane to JFK. Today I flew over the Midwest, filling out a questionnaire on the emotional life of the brain and personal capacity for resilience against despair. I was making a sculpture of my limbic systems in a huge conceptual neurosis. Under the simulated middle-class environment of the fuselage, the snow was falling. And in everyone's skulls, complex regimes went on and on and on. I seek forever the right way to know this, that there are bridges not built in me, that there are areas that do not light up. You are at a party having a conversation with an interesting stranger. You are in a restaurant and the service is bad. You have experienced profound grief. How do you react to this? Down on the ground, your family writhes. Down on the ground, you are surrounded at Starbucks with a terrible glow, and you have seen someone you love with a colossal, complex vehemence die, and it is pinned under glass in perfect condition. It is wrapped around you like old fur. You've looked at the sky until your eyes touched zodiacal fantasies right there in the void. You know this, that the body lays down while the mind bloats on intellectual chaos. And you've just eaten a bag of cinnamon-flavored chips and assessed that if you met a wonderful new person who ran from you in horror, you would fill their space with calculated desolation. Thus you are waking up, having traveled through time. You're looking down at the Statue of Liberty, garden gnome with her arm in the air, her head full of strangers, and you hear crickets lined up, playing their creepy violins, and you want to be good, and you want to be liked, and you want to recover.
Reading a science article on the airplane to JFK. That's from the collection Someone Else's Wedding Vows. And you're listening to Bianca Stone here on New Letters on the Air. Well, you've done some collaboration with Ann Carson, who was your teacher.
Yes, at NYU.
And it's a book called Antigonic. So how was it illustrating someone else's work as opposed to your own?
That was really challenging because we weren't sure how we wanted to, quote-unquote, illustrate this.
And it's a translation of Antigone, I should say that, by Sophocles, right?
Ann Carson's translation, it reminds me a lot of poetry comics because she takes so many liberties and she puts a lot of what's not in Sophocles' work into her translation, like Virginia Woolf and Hegel, make appearances. And I just love this idea of there being a whole new work of art out of somebody else's work of art. So there's this really kind of collaboration across time. And being able to, like, feel like you're not beholden to translate it exactly how Sophocles had it. Like, we have a million of those. But I think what Anne does so amazingly in everything she touches is just totally make it her own with her own voice and with such honor to these artists who have come in the past. To me, it's like an ekphrastic poem, which is poetry about art. You interact with this other person's artwork and just completely make a new thing out of it in response to everything you felt when looking at their piece. So enter Bianca, you know, just graduated from NYU, and Anne's like, we'd really like you to make a comic book with us, but we don't want any text in the images. So me and her wonderful partner and fellow thinker, Robert Curry, came up with the idea of vellum pages, which is a translucent paper, obviously, and printing the images on those and having them overlay the text so that you can experience the text through the image. And then also when you turn the vellum page, it's all by itself on a blank page on the other side. So what I love about that book is it's such a new way of experiencing art and text together, which is, I think, one of the most exciting things about experimenting with poetry comics is just ways in which to put art and text together. It's not just one sitting next to the other. So this was really a kind of radical layering of incorporating text. Also, she wrote out the entire text by hand, so there's that visual element of it, too.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so
Antigone is the name. You know, I have to say there's a line in one of your poems, and I couldn't help but think of this. It's called The People of Distress, and you say, the people of distress would get smaller, and the essential classical masterpieces would get bigger, and they would come out, the great tutors, into the cool night breeze, perfect gentlemen, great madams, to look at the stars of our hemisphere. And I don't know why, but that rung through. With you, you admire the great tutors like Anne Carson, like your grandmother, Ruth Stone. I mean, you do want to build on what they are sharing with you. And
yeah, I think that there's such a powerful poetry community right now, and poetry is in such a good place. But I think a lot of young writers don't look back enough as they should onto what's come before. I feel a great kinship for the past, and I really want to look back on what's been done and build on it. And ironically, I've found that that's where real innovation comes about, you know, real new stuff. You know, it's just like Anne's, you know, going all the way back to Sophocles and then making something so entirely new out of it. I don't know, it's just very beautiful thinking about it that way. And I have such respect for my elders and the people who have come before. And poets sometimes feel like they've gone out of style and are irrelevant. And it's kind of devastating. Fads come and go with poetry, but there's these just wonderful, wonderful poets that don't get recognized enough nowadays, like Grandma. I mean, a lot of what I'm doing now is trying to make her work relevant to young people and bring it into a new light.
Bianca Stone, talking about her grandmother, the late Ruth Stone, while a 2016 guest of Pleiades Press at the University of Central Missouri. For links to the foundation that Bianca chairs and to her poetry comics from the Book of Hours, Someone Else's Wedding Vows, and Antigone, go to our website, newletters.org. Sign up for our free weekly podcast under Ways to Listen, or find us on iTunes. Follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter at New Letters Radio. A production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Partial financial support comes from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was produced with Cassie Vaughn, Danny Moran, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.